Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to cover Psalms chapter 52. This is a psalm of David. The heading for this psalm says this: For the director of music, that's the choir director, a maskil of David, a maskil is some kind of musical term. We don't know exactly what it means. When Doeg the Edomite had gone to Saul and told him, David has gone to the house of Ahimelech. Now, we're going to talk about the historical setting of the psalm. It was written by David at a very bad time of his life when Saul was persecuting him and chasing him. David had gone to the priest at Nob. He was on the run. He was hungry. And the priest at Nob, which was near the Mount of Olives, it's where the priesthood was at the time during Saul's regime. David went there and got some bread, if you recall the story. Now, let me read some of that story in 1 Samuel 22, 9 through 19, so we'll get some background of this psalm. Then Doeg the Edomite, who was standing by the servants of Saul, said, I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob. The son of Jesse, of course, is David. Doeg the Edomite says he saw Jesse going to Nob to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub. Ahimelech's the high priest there at Nob. Verse 10, 1 Samuel 22. Doeg continues, He, that's Ahimelech, inquired of the Lord for him, for David, gave him provisions, and gave him the sword of Goliath of the Philistine. Then the king sent someone to summon Ahimelech the priest, that's King Saul, sent someone to summon Ahimelech the priest, the son of Ahitub, and all his father's household, the priests who were in Nob, and all of them came to the king. Saul said, Listen now, son of Ahitub. And Ahitub answered, Here I am, my lord. Saul then said to him, Why have you and the son of Jesse conspired against me, in that you have given him bread and a sword and have inquired of God for him, so that he would rise up against me by lying in ambush as it is this day? Then Ahimelech answered the king and said, And who among all your servants is as faithful as David, even the king's son-in-law, who is captain over your guard and is honored in your house? And what Ahimelech is saying here, why shouldn't I feed David? He's the king's son-in-law. He's a military captain. He's honored in the house of Saul. What's so subversive about giving him bread when he's hungry? Ahimelech continues, Did I just begin to inquire of God for him today? I've been inquiring of God, maybe using the Urim and the Thummim, for David before, and so he's coming to ask me again, What's the big deal? Why is anything different? And then Ahimelech says, Far be it from me. Do not let the king impute anything to his servant or to any of the household of my father, for your servant knows nothing at all of this whole affair. The whole affair of David running from Saul. But the king said, You shall surely die, Ahimelech, you and all your father's household. And the king said to the guards who were attending him, Turn around and put the priest of the Lord to death, because their hand also is with David, and because they knew that he was fleeing and did not reveal it to me. But the servants of the king were not willing to put forth their hands to attack the priest of the Lord. Then the king said to Doeg, You turn around and attack the priest. And Doeg the Edomite turned around and attacked the priest, and he killed that day 85 men who wore the linen ephod. And he struck Nob, the city of the priest, with the edge of the sword, both men and women, children and infants, also oxen, donkeys, and sheep he struck with the edge of the sword. So you see, Doeg the Edomite was a very unrighteous man. He killed a bunch of innocent priests. Saul accused them of something they were not guilty of. Saul's soldiers wouldn't kill priests because they knew they were innocent, and it scared them to do that. But not Doeg the Edomite, he just slaughtered them, along with their women and children and their livestock. So when we read in verse 1, Why do you boast in evil, O mighty man? David is referring to Doeg, who falsely accused him, and then who killed all the priests at Nob. Now, we don't have written record of Doeg boasting in his evil. Adam Clark speculates that Doeg probably boasted to Saul of his loyalty as he informed on David. John Gill suggests that Doeg may have boasted on the murders he committed. That's probably what he did. And then David calls him, O mighty man. Well, now there's a problem here because Doeg was only the chief herdsman of Saul. He was responsible for Saul's sheep. So why would David call him a mighty man? We see that he was a chief herdsman in 1 Samuel 21:7. Now, one of the servants of Saul was there that day, detained before the Lord, and his name was Doeg the Edomite, the chief of Saul's shepherds. So David calls him a mighty man. That seems sort of strange. Now, this has led some to deny the authenticity of the heading because he's called a mighty man in the inspired text, but the heading calls him Doeg. Well, the heading is not necessarily inspired, and so some people say, well, maybe the heading's wrong. I don't think that's necessary. Adam Clark suggests that the chief herdsman may have been a man of credit and authority. I mean, after all, he's taken care of all of Saul's sheep, and I'm sure there was a lot of sheep. That was a big financial responsibility that Doeg had. That's Clark's suggestion, but Gill, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, they suggest that David's reference to Doeg as a mighty man is an ironic reference to Doeg's so-called feat of arms, slaughtering 85 innocent priests, and David saying, "Oh, what a great man you are, Doeg." I prefer that solution to the slight problem. David continues in verse 1, "The loving kindness of God endures all day long." In other words, David is saying, no matter how much evil Doeg had done, God's loving kindness would still prevail. As a matter of fact, David, as well as the priesthood, survived that horrible massacre. David says in verse 2, "Doeg, your tongue devises destruction like a sharp razor." Ahimelech's family was cut to pieces by Doeg like a sharp razor. Doeg's tongue cut quietly but deeply, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says. He just simply said, "I saw David there." And then Saul did the rest at first. Doeg's tongue, by informing on David, first caused the slaughter, and then Doeg's sword finished the job. David calls Doeg at the end of verse 2, "O worker of deceit." Adam Clark says on this that Doeg was like a barber who pretends to cut the beard, but instead cuts the helpless victim's throat. A wonderful image there that sort of gives me the willies. And then, of course, Selah is there, that term that nobody knows what it means. Probably means pause, interlude, while we sing this psalm. Again, it's a musical psalm. I like this. You're singing about an evil man, a murderer, and you put it in a hymn. We go now to Psalms 52, verses 4 through 7. David continues, "You love all words that devour, O deceitful tongue." He's talking to Doeg. He calls him a tongue. This is poetry, remember. Verse 5, "But God will break you down forever." I like that translation. That's the New American Standard Bible. The KJV has, "God will destroy you forever." The NIV says that God will bring you down to everlasting ruin. Now let me repeat the obvious, but that which is ignored by the modern age, God is a God of justice. Now, he's also a God of loving kindness. In verse 1, David says that the loving kindness of God endures all day long. That's towards the saints, those who are the holy ones of God, who believe in God. For them, God's loving kindness lasts forever. But now, for people like Doeg, who are murderers, God's going to break you down. God is a God of justice as well as of mercy. If you think about loving kindness, that word shows up over and over again in the Psalms. I haven't done an actual count on it. I've just noticed it as I've gone through. Everywhere you see God's loving kindness, and so many people say there's no loving kindness of God in the Old Testament. Oh, yes, there is. There's mercy everywhere in the Old Testament, just like there's judgment in the New Testament. Remember the Olivet Discourse? Was that judgment? How about the book of Revelation? How about Jesus turning over the money changers' tables in the temple? Plenty of judgment and wrath in the New Testament, and there's plenty of loving kindness in the Old Testament because you're talking about the same God in both covenants. Here's another psalm of David where God is predicted to destroy David's enemies. Psalms 21, verse 9. "You, God, will make them," his enemies, "as a fiery oven in the time of your anger. The Lord will swallow them up in his wrath, and fire will devour them." There's a lot of people in this world who are experiencing a fiery oven of God's judgment, and you don't even have to wait till the afterlife in hell. Just look at how they're living on earth. I watch Lifetime movies. Those movies are based upon a lot of them true stories, and even the ones that aren't true are based upon the experience of human beings. That's where the writers get their material from, and it's not pleasant. There's a lot of people living in hell. I just saw a true story about a professional worldwide wrestler. I do not follow professional wrestling. I think it's the hokiest sport in the world. But this one particular guy, Lex Luthor, I think that was his name. Sounds like a Batman villain. He had made millions of dollars, watched his girlfriend overdose and die from drugs. He was strung out on drugs. He ended up in jail over and over again. And down in Atlanta, a prison minister led this man to the Lord. And as you read his story, he thought he was literally in hell, right here on earth, before he went to the afterlife. Fortunately, he got saved, and his life has totally changed. And this happens all the time when people give their life to Christ. But there's a lot of people out there who don't want to give their life to Christ. Nice people. And they just think that the world's going to treat them right. And if they can just find the right husband or the right wife. They can just find the right job. Everything's going to be all right if they just had enough money. Well, guess what? It's not going to happen. So David says in verse 5 that God will snatch Doeg up and tear Doeg away from his tent and uproot him from the land of the living. Well, what does that mean? There's two options. David could be saying that Doeg's temporal life will be destroyed as he is torn away from his tent, his body, and he's uprooted from the land of the living, so he's not living anymore. He's dead. But as John Gill says, it could be that Doeg is being predicted by David here to be about to lose his eternal life. I always think that David mainly thinks about this life. I don't get the feeling that the people in the Old Testament talked about the afterlife too much, although there are some indications thereof. David continues in verse 6, "The righteous will see and fear." See what? See the fact that Doeg has been torn away from his tent and uprooted from the land of the living? The righteous are going to see that. Punishment always has as its aim the vindication of and instruction in righteousness, either in this world or the next, as John Gill suggests. Now, here are some other scriptures that talk about the righteous seeing and fearing and laughing at the unrighteous. This is what verse 6 says, "The righteous will see and fear and will laugh at the unrighteous man." So let's look at some scriptures that reflect that idea. Exodus 15:1, this is the song of Moses, one of them. "Then Moses and the sons of Israel sang this song to the Lord and said, 'I will sing to the Lord, for he is highly exalted.'" Why will Moses sing to the Lord? "The horse and rider God has hurled into the sea." Well, that's laughing over the unrighteous, is it not? Revelation 18:20, "Rejoice over her, O heaven, and you saints and apostles and prophets, because God has pronounced judgment for you against her." Now, this is referring to Babylon. This is eschatology. People disagree on what Babylon is. I think it's referring to the Old Testament rabbinic system of Judaism. I think I can prove that, but not here. It doesn't matter what Babylon is. God has pronounced judgment for you, for the church, you saints and apostles and prophets, for you, saints and apostles and prophets. God has pronounced judgment for you against Babylon. And then, at the first of Revelation 18:20, we see this phrase, "Rejoice over her. Rejoice over Babylon. Rejoice, you saints and apostles and prophets." A little bit of Schadenfreude, rejoicing over the downfall of your enemy. How about Revelation 19, verses 1 and 2? "After these things I," this is John the Apostle, "heard something like a loud voice of a great multitude in heaven saying, 'Hallelujah! Salvation and glory and power belong to our God, because his judgments are true and righteous. For he has judged the great harlot," that's Babylon the Great, "who was corrupting the earth with her immorality, and he has avenged the blood of his bondservants on her." Well, look at that. God's judgments are righteous. God has judged Babylon the Great, and he's avenged the blood of his Christians on Babylon. Now, what do the voices of the great multitude in heaven have to say about that? Here, "Hallelujah!" Is that not Schadenfreude? Rejoicing over the downfall of your enemies? How about another psalm written by David, Psalm 58, verse 10? "The righteous will rejoice when he sees the vengeance. He," the righteous man, "will wash his feet in the blood of the wicked." He will rejoice when he sees the vengeance of God. Okay, that seems pretty clear, right? Well, how do we reconcile this idea of Schadenfreude, rejoicing over the downfall of one's enemies, with these following verses? Proverbs 24:17, "Do not rejoice when your enemy falls, and do not let your heart be glad when he stumbles." Whoa, that seems like a direct contradiction, does it not? Here's Obadiah 1, verses 12 through 13. "Do not gloat over your brother's day, the day of his misfortune. And do not rejoice over the sons of Judah in the day of their destruction. Yes, do not boast in the day of their distress." Verse 13, dot, 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 "Do not gloat over their calamity in the day of their disaster." That sounds like don't do Schadenfreude, the direct opposite of the previous verses I read. Proverbs 17:5 says, "He who mocks the poor taunts his maker. He who rejoices at calamity will not go unpunished." Well, the context of that verse might explain it. This sounds like somebody's mocking an innocent man, not an enemy, but an innocent man. Well, of course, that would be stupid to mock somebody. Not only stupid, but immoral to mock a poor man because he's poor. So we won't count Proverbs 17:5 as rejoicing over the downfall of an enemy. But Job says in Job 31, verse 29, "Have I rejoiced at the extinction of my enemy or exulted when evil befell him?" And of course, Job is trying to prove that he's innocent. And one of the ways that he can prove that he is innocent is he's saying, "Look, I never rejoiced when my enemy fell." So how do we reconcile those two sets of scriptures? Here's how John Gill does it. Option number one, Gill makes a distinction between the enemies of God and one's personal enemies. He gives as an example the verse I quoted in Obadiah, "Do not gloat over your brother's day." Oh, that's a personal enemy. You're not supposed to gloat over a personal enemy. But if it's God's enemies, we can. But the problem with that, the brother is probably the Edomite, Esau being the brother of Jacob, and Edom is not a personal enemy, so I don't think that flies. The pulpit commentary says the way you reconcile these verses is that it's okay to gloat in the Old Testament, but not in the New Testament. Well, I don't know. I just read you some verses in Revelation 18 and Revelation 19 about, hallelujah, the bad guys have fallen. Babylon the Great has been judged by God. That's in the New Testament. So I don't think that the pulpit commentary solution is worthwhile. Here's the best answer of all. The joy that is expressed here is over justice that is done. It is not joy over personal revenge. Now, that's very similar to what Gill said, a distinction between the enemies of God, that would be justice being done on the enemies of God, and one's personal enemies would be revenge. So those really are two different ways of saying the same thing. But let's look at how Colin Delitzsch expresses this. The laughing is joy. Now, what laughing is he talking about? Let me back up. In verse 6 of Psalm 52, David says, "The righteous will see and fear and will laugh at the unrighteous." Colin Delitzsch says, "The laughing is joy at the ultimate breaking through of justice, long hidden and not discerned. For even the moral teaching of the Old Testament," referring to Proverbs 24:17, "reprobates the low, malignant joy that glories at the overthrow of one's enemy." Proverbs 24:17 is the one I just read, which says, "Do not rejoice when your enemy falls, and do not let your heart be glad when he stumbles." That's talking about personal enemies. Colin Delitzsch say it's not talking about justice being executed by God. I've got an even better quote from Albert Barnes. Quote, "The idea here is not exultation in the sufferings of others, or joy that calamity has come upon them, or the gratification of selfish and revengeful feeling that an enemy is deservedly punished. It is that of approbation that punishment has come upon those who deserve it, and joy that wickedness is not allowed to triumph. It is not wrong for us to feel a sense of approbation and joy that the laws are maintained and that justice is done, even though this does involve suffering. For we know that the guilty deserve it, and it is better that they should suffer than that the righteous should suffer through them. All this may be entirely free from any malignant or any revengeful feeling. It may even be connected with the deepest pity and with the purest benevolence toward the sufferers themselves. It took me years to come to that. My culture says, oh, don't say anything bad about evil. We can't do any punishment on people because that just shows vengeance and revenge, and vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. And nobody ever made the distinction between justice, which has to be done. Don't judge me. I'm not going to judge you. Person standing over the corpse, blood dripping off the knife. Well, gee, I don't want to judge you for that. No, I rejoice when killers are put in the electric chair and fried. I rejoice not because they've done anything to me, but I rejoice because justice has been done and they have taken one of God's creations made in the image of God and snuffed him out. We should be glad when that kind of justice is done. We go now to Psalms 52, verses 8 through 9, and we will finish this audio. David continues, "But as for me, I am like a green olive tree in the house of God. I trust in the loving kindness of God forever and ever. I will give you thanks forever, because you have done it. And I will wait on your name, for it is good in the presence of your godly ones." Now, when David says, "I am like a green olive tree," remember, at the time of the writing of this psalm, he was on the run from Saul. He wasn't too much like a green olive tree. He was more like a tumbling tumbleweed tumbling through the deserts outside of Jerusalem. But he's speaking in faith here. He knows he's going to be established like a green olive tree. Now, why an olive tree? As the NIV Study Bible says, the ancient Hebrews honored the olive tree as the king of trees. It was considered a symbol of many good things, such as beauty, virility, prosperity, divine blessing. It was an appropriate metaphor for David, because David was a king, He was a warrior. He was a singer. He was a poet. He was a man of God. He was a green olive tree. He will trust in the loving kindness of God forever and ever. And there's that word again, loving kindness. This olive tree metaphor is very common in the Old Testament. Here's Psalm 1, the author of which we don't know. Psalms 1, verse 3. He, that means the righteous man, will be like a tree firmly planted by streams of water, which yields its fruit in its season, and its leaf does not wither, and in whatever he does, he prospers. It doesn't say it's an olive tree, but it's a tree. Jeremiah 11:16 does refer to a green olive tree. The Lord called your name a green olive tree, beautiful in fruit and form. With the noise of great tumult, he has kindled fire on it, and its branches are worthless. Talking about Israel, used to be a green olive tree. Now David says in verse 9, I will give you, God, thanks forever. Now again, I've said this many, many times, that word forever can either mean during one's lifetime or it can mean all through eternity. Not really sure what David meant there. I will give you thanks forever because you have done it, and I will wait on your name. And remember, waiting is not like waiting in a bus station for a bus. It means waiting in confident expectation and hope. And of course, what does it mean to wait on the name of someone? The name is a symbol of all the aggregated attributes of somebody. He's not waiting on some text written on a piece of paper. No, he's waiting on God and all of whom God is. David says in verse 9, I will wait on the name of God, for it is good. God's name is good, of course, in the presence of your godly ones, in the presence of God's saints. KJV and the NIV actually translates that as saints, the godly ones. They're Old Testament saints as well as New Testament saints. So ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished Psalms 52. That prepares us to go to Psalms 53 in our next audio. That psalm we will entitle, There is None Who Does Good. Sounds like the Apostle Paul in Romans. There is none who does good. Psalms 53, 1 through 6. We'll take that up in our next audio. I hope you stay tuned for that one, and I hope you enjoyed this one.